Welcome, everybody, to Silver Shield Report number 57. This is more or less a sequel of our last one about embracing the abundance mentality. But before I get into that, I do want to give an update on the coins that we're doing. The limited edition coins are being put off until probably the end of this week. We are still behind on the Trivium proofs, and I told the guys we're not going to launch anything we can't deliver in a very rapid pace. We've worn out a lot of goodwill with the Debt and Death medallion, mainly because of, we were kind of surprised about the amount that we had sold, and we only could produce about 5 coins per minute, so it was a mathematical thing. Then there was about a 2 to 3 week delay with the art process, another 2 to 3 week delay with all the ton of silver that we brought up to the mint to get made into blanks. But all these problems are behind us. They have both new presses coming in and the high-speed feeders for them, which is going to make the production go from 5 to 75 coins per minute, which is going to be a game changer for us. And then they brought in a burnishing tub to create our own proof blanks. Just so you know, like when you get the silver blanks, if you've ever seen like a metal slug that, you know, the construction user works with, that's what a plain silver round looks like. It's very unpolished and unfinished and doesn't look all that great. Whereas a proof blank will look beautiful by itself. It'll just be like a mirrored image and you're stamping it on there and it makes it look perfect. So they're getting the burnishing equipment to do that themselves. I think they posted a YouTube video about that. I'm going to be doing a bigger silver YouTube update. But you did not miss the limited edition coins. They're still going to be available. But I don't want to get in the habit of taking your money and then sitting on it for 2 weeks or a month or whatever. So I'd much rather, wait until they actually get this done. We actually have, I think, 10,000 blank proof planchettes coming in within the next week. So one way or the other, we're going to get them done. And also, as a result, we're not going to be releasing the... All right, so that's the 2012 proof queen. And then the New Year's coins, there's going to be 2013 of those, 2012 of the queen, and that's going to be the first limited editions. It's only going to be available to our members. I won't sell them to any of the public. So basically, if you ever see one on eBay, know that it's one of our guys that are selling one of them. And as a result, we're also not going to be selling the proof queens or the Debt and Death kind of strike with the BU on one side and the proof on the other side on January 1st. So the next coin that you're going to see available is going to be the BU 2013 queen. And, as soon as we get the proof part down where the production's great and we can produce it, then we'll sell that. So that's where we are going forward. But let's get on to the main part of this. So much of our life is actually just a mind game. We have so much power inside of us, and the elite know this. And one of the main tools that they use to weaken ourselves and knowing that our problems start and stop with us is that they always focus on what we can't do well and try to say, like, you know, here, do this better. So if, in school, they teach you to work on your faults, work on the things that aren't good about you, and you might get pretty good at it if you put enough energy to it. But this is actually a kind of a diabolical way of making somebody depressed and unenergized about doing things and making them feel like they can't do stuff. What we should be doing in school is identifying what strengths, what comes natural, what talents somebody has, and emphasizing and accentuating and encouraging that. But we don't do that. In a collective society, they want us all dumbed down on the same level. So they have us focuses on our Fs instead of our As. And we did a Silver Shield report with Risa, I forget her last name, probably halfway through last year, I'd have to look it up, talking about how her education system really focuses on kids who have talents and identifying them. So the whole idea of working towards that is an empowering thing. And when you focus on your positive aspects and really develop those talents, you start to find things that you love doing and will do it for free, do it without eating, do it without thinking. You just end up doing it because you love it. And when you encourage kids and young adults and eventually adults to pursue that, they'll find that there are far, far more successful working on their strengths than ever working back on things that they cannot do. So in our school system, we're taught to work on our faults and taught to work by ourselves. Okay. In a next paradigm opposite consciousness school system, we would focus on our skills and our powers and our things that are our talents, our things that we're most best at. And the opposite consciousness of working by ourselves and competitive and on all that other stuff is being cooperative. So if you've ever seen comic books or the X-Men movies, each of the superheroes are taught to work on their superpower that they have. Some can shoot lasers with their eyes. Some are super strong. Some have, you know, are indestructible and all that other stuff. Individually, if they all work to the together on their faults, you know, the guy who's super strong can never shoot lasers, but, you know, maybe with enough, you know, time and talent, he could try to do that. But he would feel like a failure because he can't do what doesn't come natural to him. But in the X-Men, they teach them how to work on their strengths and then work as a team to fill in all the gaps. So the foundation of this is the Trivium. The Trivium actually breaks that slave mentality, works on developing logical, thoughtful response towards new stimulus. But once you kind of get past the Trivium, it's what's your natural impulse, what to do with that information. And there's actually four different areas that people tend to go to. And when you're developing a team or an organization, it's very important to identify the different tasks by what needs to be done. So if you look at a business, usually, or an organization or a teamwork or something along those lines, usually people will fit into four different categories. The first one inevitably is the quick start people. The quick start people are the ones that come up with the idea for the organization or come up with the product or come up with the business or come up with the service or come up with the task at hand. These are the ones that are the visionaries, the ones that you know, see things clearly, can take a lot of information, see where the market's going and get ahead of it. These are the people that actually create all the real wealth out there. And we need to, you know, find these people and, you know, give them the tools necessary to go out and do this type of stuff. But quick start people by themselves are very weak because they may have – may come up with a ton of ideas. You know, they could be a fountainhead of knowledge. It could be, you know, tons of great ideas and things. But if they don't have somebody else to follow through, which quick start people are notoriously bad at – you know, they come up with the dreams and the ideas and stuff like that. But if they don't have a teamwork, a system of actually implementing and creating and designing and doing their ideas, these things all end up doing nothing. So while the quick starts are very important, they're the initial spark, but the real flame, the real power is all the other people that back them up. Following the quick start is the implementers. Okay, so this is the second level. The first one's the quick start people. The next one's the implementers. Implementers are the ones that take the vision. They're not ones that can come up with a lot of creative ideas, but can start to actually produce what has been imagined. They tend not to have this entrepreneurial spirit. They would like organization. They like the security of steadiness and stuff like that, and really are good at looking interpreting what the quick start guys envision, and then also create the systems in place, you know, out of nowhere. You know, it's very creative level to do that. And then actually get a system done, get a product done, get an idea done, get a campaign done, get something done. These are the ones that are actually the doers. So if you ever hear of the right-hand man or the second, you know, the second in charge type guys, these guys are probably the implementers. These are the ones that actually get stuff done. And if you're looking to get stuff done in a business, you really don't want to talk to the CEO who's more, you know, visionary and ethereal and stuff like that. You really want to talk to the number two guy, the kind of, you know, the COO as opposed to the CEO. And then once you have a system set up, you need the follow-through people. So the follow-through people are the ones that maintain a organization. They're good at adjusting procedures and monitoring policies and realigning objectives and coordinators. These are kind of the tinkers, the middlemen, the guys that like to, you know, the accountant type people who want to kind of manipulate a system that the implementers already created and the visionaries or the quick start guy visionaries produced. These are highly essential inside of a corporation, because once the implementer has created a system, they tend to move on to keep up with the quick starts to do something else. But it's the follow-through people that continue to generate the profits and the ideas and the churning of the organization over and over again. And then finally, there's the fact finders. And the fact finder people are the ones that become energized by finding stuff out. So they're the researchers. They could help the implementers. They could help the quick start, and they can help the follow-through people by finding out things. You know, if the quick start guy has an idea, a fact finder might say, hey, this market is good. We found out all this research, and that might inspire the quick start guy to move towards something else. The implementer needs the fact finders to help them figure out what actually works. You know, the implementer can come up with systems and ideas, but if the system doesn't actually work, what good is it? And then the follow through people need the fact finder, like through customer service. My wife would become empowered by talking to 30, 40 people about, you know, all the problems that they were having with their cars and stuff like that. She would get empowered by it. And yet I would be drained by it. So once you've identified where, you know, what you naturally, you know, your first impulse, that's what this is, the impulse of knowing what you want to do. These kind of four things can help you start to realize, well, geez, you know, I'm in a fact-finding job, but I'm a quick start kind of guy. No wonder I'm depressed at work. So if you're a fact finder, chances are you're probably not going to be a good manager. You need really follow-through people who get off on the managing of people and designs and stuff like that. But you know, the fact finder really is more of the sociable person who wants to find out things and feel things and do things. So we're taught not to work as a team. We're taught to work on ourselves and work on our negatives, and this builds up that scarcity mentality. And the Trivium frees us by observing our powers. So if you look at these four action modes, our school system really does not encourage and actively probably works against the number one and number two mindsets of people by taking away their creativity, by forcing them into a very centralized, structured system. Quick start people and implementers tend not to thrive in those environments, especially quick start people. That's why I was so disengaged throughout my entire school system. I couldn't wait for things to get done. I always doodled. I always drew. I always, you know, was daydreaming. I was always doing something other than what I was supposed to do. And that's why my grades stunk. And it wasn't because I wasn't intelligent, because I can actually say the 1 year I actually studied my ass off and actually worked hard was my freshman year of college. Many of you may or may not know, but I was a C student in high school. I hated school. I wasn't a very good athlete, and when I applied to go to college, I actually got rejected from 13 colleges, and all of them. And it wasn't until I got into Ursinus College that I said, "Well, wow, I definitely don't want to spend the next 3 or 4 years here, so I'm going to study." And I took politics, I took Japanese as a language, I took economics, I took all sorts of classes. I studied, and I got straight A's. And I applied to all the colleges that rejected me. I got into all of them, including Boston College, which is where I inevitably went. And then I once again slacked off for the next 3 years, getting two D's in politics in my senior year, which I told the one professor, D equals diploma. But the four action modes of our indoctrination system work against the quick start people and the implementers, but actually thrives the fact finders and the follow through people, especially the fact finders, because those are the little drones that don't think. And if you're one of those, it's not bad. My wife is an excellent fact finder, but she's not the one that's going to create a business. She's not the one that's going to come up with new ideas. She's not the one that's going to come up with the next product. But I tell you what, if you have a product that's done, or need help or need something done, she's the person to do it. She gets empowered by it. So really, this is kind of a war against the innovators, the quick starts, the people who actually get stuff done, and the ones that do show that spark, but can be bought into this collectivist system, are attracted to Wall Street, or attracted to Washington, D.C., or attracted to L.A., the movie industry, the television industry, where they then are fed into the shark mentality of highly competitive scarcity, and they're brought up through there. But very, you know, rare is the kind of people who are quick start implementers, logical thinkers who are actively not in those areas. And I think that that's something, if once we identify who and what we are, we can start ourselves building up that power. But in our school system, we're taught divide and conquer, competition with others. It's never work together on projects. It's never recognize individual powers and then having other people work together to get things done. It's always a centralized power structure where little drones do exactly what the authority figure tells you. You're supposed to regurgitate information, not debate information. It has nothing to do with the Socratic method of learning about things, and we have to focus on what we're bad at. Very rare is the parent-teacher conference about, you know, Jimmy's getting straight A's in math, and this kid's an absolute genius and can solve this stuff without even studying it. It's always, well, then he's bad in Spanish, and we have to work on his Spanish. And what is the amount of time that the parents and the teachers then focus on is the kid's F in Spanish. I am not a linguistic person, even though I talk and write for a living. I cannot, you know, learn other languages. I'm not inspired to learn it. I don't like learning it, and I'd rather work on things that I enjoy. And it wasn't until I got out of college and started learning on my own that I started reading these 240 books. I actually felt my brain expanding. Google helped me see that there was a lot more information out there than I had been shown throughout my indoctrination process. And the indoctrination process uses our powers under scarcity to serve others. So when we are in this indoctrination thing, we work through scarcity. We have to fight on the things that we're bad at and stuff like that, and our grades, and fight with other people. And then, you know, what levels are you? And then, you know, are you going to get into college? And it's competition. But the reality is, the ones that I've seen that are most successful in life are the ones that cooperate the most and not competition. The ones that identify their skill sets the most and appreciate and encourage and empower other people to do those skill sets, that's the organizations that thrive. That's the people that you know, are the happiest at doing their job. You know, geez, put me in a position where I have to do you know, monotonous work like web programming and customer service and chargebacks and all that other stuff that I had to do through this. It takes away my power, and I could do 2 hours of it, and my brain is just like fried. Whereas I could do, you know, new videos and new things and come up with new ideas and coin designs and all, you know, all this stuff. And I'll be working all hours and forget to eat, because I love it so much. And I, and when I'm done with 12, 14 hours a day, I'm actually so energized. My brain can't even go to sleep when I need to. And yet when we are forced into a position where we're doing something that we don't like, this is sucking our life, and inevitably something that we need to identify and get rid of, because chances are this is not something that's empowering you, resonating with you. It's probably just sucking the life out of you. And here's a good example. If you're doing a job where you're waiting to retire, you're wasting your life. I mean, think about the whole process of waiting to retire. You're actively or passively admitting that you hate what you do and cannot wait until you're done. You're actually going to waste many of your best years doing something that you actively hate, waiting to retire. Because I tell you what, if you're doing something that you really like, retirement's not even a thought. It's how can you do your job better? How can you do what you do better? And I really, you know, geez, this is a great time before an economic collapse to start thinking about what you really would like doing, identifying your power. What are your action modes? What do you love reading? What do you love doing? What are your superpowers? What provides value to others? And this is what's going to make you happier and ultimately more successful in doing what you're doing. Between competition and cooperating, that's the scarcity or abundance. If you're getting married to looking for somebody else to fill the hole in your life, and it's a competition to get the most out of each other, then you end up playing games of manipulating others with withholding love or compassion or money or something in order to manipulate to get what you want out of them through that scarcity mentality. That's eventually going to lead to a toxic relationship. from a toxic person. And the only way to enter into any relationship, you know, a marriage or a job or a community or something like that, is when you recognize your strengths and weaknesses, and you give your strengths without thought, 100% of your strength, without expecting anything in return. So I mentioned before that my wife's uncle, Theo Vasili, from Greece, his one suggestion on my wedding day is just love one another 100% without even the thought of getting anything back. And that's the only way that you're going to be able to do that. And this is the same way that in an organization or in a business or in a good group of people without toxic people that suck your energies from you, you can give 100% of your strengths and work with others that complement your weaknesses. And these are what we need to start looking at in our families, in our relationships, in our networks, in our organizations, in our, you know, whatever you're with. Start identifying these things and let other people know about that so they can start being honest with themselves. But once you do this, you activate this in other people. And this is where this abundance mentality kicks in, that others are far more productive when they're put in a position that they can thrive doing something that they love doing, as opposed to forcing a round or square peg in a round hole. It doesn't work. The mentality of scarcity tells us that by focusing on our lack, we'll never activate our abundance. And that's what a centralized structure has. They want drones. They want everybody melded into one kind of mass that works excellent in a military, you know, charging over hills and taking bullets for the bankers in the back. That works great in corporations where they're able to, you know, squeeze more hours out of them, or, you know, have them do repetitive jobs over and over and over again. It's great in governments where, you know, bureaucracies are known to just drone on and do things. And that's why the institutions of education reflect what corporations, militaries, and governments need, not what individuals and humanity needs. And this purposely is withholding abundance from humanity. So Adam Smith actually tapped into this abundance mentality with the division of labor. By people focusing on only their talents, and they become more proficient at the task and become highly abundant. So I forget what the exact example is, but if you took a pin maker and had one person create a pin from start to finish, from clipping the wire to sharpening it to doing all this other stuff, he may only produce, I don't know, 60 per minute. But if you took you know, the process into four different levels, where one person did each of their one job over and over and over again, they may produce 6,000 in that same time period, simply because they become better at doing what they're doing. And there's no time gap and a whole bunch of other stuff. But the elite use this knowledge of the abundance mentality, but siphoned off our abundance into centralized structures that harvest that power. So corporations are a perfect example of that. They create centralized structures that embrace that abundance mentality, but then siphon all of its energy into a centralized structure. And guess who rises to the top of those centralized structures? The psychopaths, the predators, the ones that don't provide any value, and they garner all the wealth for themselves. That's why you see CEOs making 350 times the average worker nowadays than, you know, back, you know, 40 or 50 years ago, when that number was maybe only 10 times what it is. And then you start to realize that, well, if a corporation is harvesting all this abundance up to the top for the predators to harvest for themselves and garner more wealth for themselves, you start to see that the real economy is based in the illusion of manipulating those to continue to work for those structures, continue to give up what is good about them, continue to sacrifice their time, energy, and money for some illusion of a retirement, a country, a profitable quarter, or something that they're all working towards. And the reality is that they're just sucking their wealth and their time and energy off to a centralized structure that is ultimately empowering the worst in humanity. So it wasn't always this way. If you look at Henry Ford maybe not Andrew Carnegie so much, but Henry Ford, while he was an industrialist, did try to give back. You know, Henry Ford paid $5 a day back when the average wage was probably about $1 a day. But he gave back to the employees because of the productive power that his automation of creating the cars and all that other stuff, he gave back to the employees so that they can create wealth. He wasn't just sucking up all the wealth for himself and then sitting on the top. He actually paid the highest wages out there. You know, even Andrew Carnegie, even though he ran all the steel mills, and I think 1 in 8 steel workers died during their term at working at his mills, Andrew Carnegie, when he left, or actually I should say when he was bought out by J.P. Morgan, spent the rest of his life giving away his wealth, you know, trying to give back to humanity. But I think Henry Ford actually had the better way of doing it is recognizing that people are being abundant towards a centralized structure and to give back to those people so that they could actually create a better way of life. And I really believe Henry Ford was really the one that created the middle class. And this middle class is getting destroyed because the psychopaths that we empower are siphoning off all the wealth for themselves, rigging the game for themselves, and withholding all that. And if you look at history, the Fords and Carnegies were ultimately beaten by the Rothschilds and Rockefellers that were the absolute, you know, vision of scarcity mentality. Rockefeller, you know, said that competition is a sin. You know, the Rothschilds, you know, talked about, you know, no matter who is in charge, so long as I control the money, you know, I'm in charge. So the Rockefellers or the Rothschilds used the monetary system to produce scarcity because, you know, their money that they created out of thin air, they siphoned it off through their systems and created interest on top of it. So they created a debt-based monetary system that was always benefiting the Rothschilds because they're the ones that created the debt. The Rockefellers, they, you know, monopolized all the oil in the United States when the United States was the Saudi Arabia of the world. And the Rothschilds and Rockefellers ultimately beat the Fords and Carnegies by either buying them out or destroying them with collectivism with the union. So, you know, just to disclose, my father-in-law is a union worker. My brother-in-law is a union worker. I do believe workers' rights are important. But when you do a collectivized effort, inevitably you're going to have, you know, the psychopaths rise to the top of that collective effort, which in this case would be the unions, that are going to siphon off most of the benefits that the workers would get to themselves. And they have these elaborate, you know, Vegas trips and retirement plans and all this other stuff. And it's really just part of the system. The solution is more like what Henry Ford did with just actually recognizing and giving the workers, you know, higher wages based off of the production that they did. But the Rothschilds and Rockefellers worked their way through consolidating competitive industries into monopolies and creating a scarcity competition of business and industries, and thereby rewarding those that played their game and crushing those that value abundance. So if you look at It's a Wonderful Life, the banker guy, I forget his name, he thrived off the scarcity mentality and took from the people. And, you know, he's a slumlord. He was a banker. He loaned money out. And Jimmy Stewart's character was much more of an abundant mentality guy, and he didn't realize how many people he had been abundant to. And it ultimately, the It's a Wonderful Life really has to do with choosing the scarcity or the abundance mentality. And that's what the Rothschilds and Rockefellers have done on an absolutely industrial global scale. They've instituted this scarcity mentality everywhere and crushed all those that value abundance, you know, the abundance mentality, by rigging the game against them without even them knowing. And that's the sad thing, is that all this wealth, all this illusion is based off of us actively or passively supporting the system. And I think when people start to realize that the system is rigged against them, walking away becomes easy, but also a very effective strategy of beating these people. And ultimately, at the end of the day, that's all that we need to work on, is just where are we actively or passively supporting? Who are we supporting? What are we doing with our lives? Where are our energies going to? Where is our money going to? Where is our eyeballs going to? Where is our attention going to? Where is our love going to? These are the things that are important. Because once we start turning it around and focusing on the right people, stop watching TV, stop supporting the military, stop keeping our money in the banks, the better off we all will be, because we're going to start withdrawing our support from these people. And yet the Rothschilds and Rockefellers defeated these abundance mentality people or any competition that just kind of didn't get along with their shark-like mentality, and they did it through debts and, or market manipulations. So when people were confronted by competition, they saw debt or competition as the only way of beating them. But this is ultimately a flaw, because as soon as you enter their game of scarcity and debt and competition and lies and all that other stuff, legal battles and stuff like that, they win because the psychopath is empowered by that mentality. It's not the opposite consciousness. And for an example, Nikola Tesla, George Westinghouse was the number one competitor to Thomas Edison's, General Electric that J.P. Morgan was behind. And what J.P. Morgan ended up doing was manipulating the stock of George Westinghouse so much so that he could barely afford to fund a lot of the projects. And because of Westinghouse's deal with Nikola Tesla, and I think the deal was that for every horsepower that George Westinghouse produced, Nikola Tesla would receive $1 in compensation. So that was the deal that he structured. Well, Nikola Tesla's programs and Westinghouse created thousands of horsepower from there, and literally, if that contract had held all the way through, he would have been a trillionaire because of the amount of energy that Nikola Tesla was responsible for creating. So when George Westinghouse got into trouble with his stock, and that hindered the financing of it, and J.P. Morgan was behind it with the short selling and all that other stuff, Nikola Tesla confronted that manipulation by giving the abundance mentality, by giving away all of his royalties to Westinghouse for free. He said that the value of humanity receiving this energy was far more than any paper profits he had. And as a result, George Westinghouse had a new business model where he was not burdened with that massive amount of wealth that he had to transfer to Nikola Tesla because of the deal of his patents. And he was able to find money out there and stay in business, so much so that Westinghouse is still in business. But Tesla used that abundance mentality to give away his royalties for free. When I heard about this, I was like, wow, this is pretty amazing stuff, because it was the exact same thing I did with the Sons of Liberty Academy. By working on something that was my intellectual property, my life's work, and then giving it away for free, that was an abundance mentality. I knew that was the right thing to do after the fact, but man, it was hard to get rid of that. So the good thing is the scarcity mentality is reaching its apex and will collapse in on itself from a toxic spiral. There'll be an anger phase as those predators that benefited the most off of this will spend more and more energy trying to maintain the status quo of an increasingly complex system that has diminishing returns. This is because the abundance of those producers has lessened. The cancer of scarcity of material gains and competition has destroyed the motivation in others to give their abundance away. So a lot of the people that are inside of this group, myself included, could be creating and doing a lot of other things and be active participants in this debt and death paradigm. We'd be incredibly valuable. I know if I was to go into Wall Street, I'm sure a shark mentality would be able to to be able to do something. If I was in the auto business or anything else, I would thrive in all these situations, but I've actively decided not to do that. And as a result, we're directing our energy and power to other people. A lot of business owners are in here, and a lot of guys have made big deals over this past year of selling their real estate, selling their businesses, selling their stocks, selling their shares, getting out of the system while they still can, and they're storing their wealth in real tangible wealth. And that's where a lot of this network of the Silvershield Group is going to eventually go. I recommend that we still stay, decentralized and kind of loose-knit, intellectually aligned people until after the cards are dealt, and then we can kind of raise our hands up and say, okay, here I am, here's what I have to offer, and here's what I can do. The end of this scarcity mentality is going to be war. And somewhere along the line, there's going to be a massive war. because that's the absolute, you know, kind of blow-off phase of that scarcity mentality. And actually, wars are very useful for the elite of destroying abundance. So I don't know how they're going to pull this off, because during World War II, they had the scarcity mentality of the Great Depression, and then the war was used to create massive amount of abundance in producing war machines that were eventually blown, you know, destroyed. So when war happens, it actually destroys the wealth of the abundance of the actual people and does not raise the standard of living. So if all that energy and all that debt and time and energy was you put into creating a sustainable way of life, the predators that own and control the system, you know, wouldn't have people to manipulate through scarcity to work for their systems. They would be able to, you know, fend for themselves, live for themselves, and not really care about the next scarcity thing. So the wars end up destroying a lot of the productive labor, but it serves a good purpose because it creates profits for the war profiteers and those that and it creates massive amount of debt, which lives on for generations. So they got the instant profits from the war, and they have the long term generational debt, and that's what these wars end up doing. And when nations go to war with each other, they usually burden the nations that lose the war with the debt. So in our case, we won the war, and we created our dollar-based global reserve currency. And yeah, it's gone through a couple forms with Bretton Woods and now the petrodollar. But we've been able to live very high off of the rest of the world through this system, and it's going to come to an end, and it's not going to end pretty, because you don't have a $1 trillion military industrial complex, you know, go down without a fight. So now we're reaching a point where the value players recognize and use the active or passive participation of the debt and death system as scarcity mentality and competition, and they're actively moving away from it. And that's what this whole silver bullet, silver shield's been about, is recognize the abundance and turn the cycle the other way. By deleveraging our abundance out of the complexity system and scarcity values, to return abundance to the ideas and people that we want to be a blessing to. And this could be just as simple as just working on your family. I mean, this doesn't mean, you know, let's, you know, go out and create our own government, or our own corporation, our own this. Just by focusing our time, energy, and money on those that really matter to us, that's really what the answer is. So the answer that Adam Smith found with the division of labor and the abundance mentality, we need to, instead of have a centralized process of the division of labor, the abundance mentality is very real and powerful. We just need a fertile field to use it in. So the opposite consciousness of this centralized thing is a decentralized voluntary cooperation and the sharing of profits and loss amongst the participants. And that's why I think equity investing is the opposite consciousness solution to the debt-based monetary system that we have. So those people who do have silver in our group, which I believe will be capital, can provide the capital to the quick start people, the idea makers or the laborers or something, you know, something to create the next generation of answers that humanity is going to need with a new value structure. And I think that we'll be able to do that. So while silver is very important to transferring wealth into the next paradigm, it is part of this equity investing where I believe that instead of the entrepreneur or the business going into debt to those that have capital, i.e. us, we need to take it upon ourselves to lend for equity, meaning that if we, say, start a bread factory, or a bakery, I guess would be the right word for it. We started a bakery, and it needed 1,000 ounces of silver to build a really great bakery, and they build all sorts of, you know, bread, and it can be used both internally in our little community, but we could also export it. The capital is very important in the initial, you know, months and years to buy the property, to buy the machinery, to build the building, to set up the structure. And all that silver really is being transmorphed into bricks and mortars and ovens and breads and material and land and stuff like that. And that instead of indebting the entrepreneur that's starting this thing, we should say, hey, you know, we're putting up 1,000 ounces of silver. How about we take, 70% of the profits towards paying off this 1,000 ounces? And then once the 1,000 ounces is paid off, we'll retain, 10%, 15%, 20%, 30% of the business that is profitable. That way, if now you have a marriage of, and not competition of capital and labor, or capital and entrepreneurs, and that now it's a cooperation as opposed to competition. Because quite honestly, nowadays when banks loan, I know that they're loaning money out of thin air, and they almost want you to fail, because then they're going to secure all the other real assets that you have, and sell it off to somebody else. And our effort with the Mint is an example of this. By supporting us with this abundance mentality and value for value relationship, it's actually spinning this vortex outwardly. So instead of the scarcity mentality kind of sucking everything in, the abundance mentality kind of spins everything out. And this past year, I feel like I've been very blessed. And it started with that leap of faith of giving away my life's work with the Sons of Liberty Academy and helping others, through all the hard work that I did. But these past 2 weeks have really been ridiculously. I mentioned before that we just had donations and opportunities and all this other stuff that's coming in, and it's now getting to the point where I'm like, I get a little scared at what can come of this, and it's good, and I realize that I need to actively start spending this energy onto others and help support others. So I hope that this Mint ends up funding, and I talked a little bit about it with Carrie over the weekend. I put up a YouTube video looking forward to 2013. We're going to have a conference in Dallas, June, 20th, I guess, somewhere around there. And it's the Liberty Mastermind. And while we're going to be a big part of that, and I don't have all the details because we just came up with the date like 2 minutes before we went to air. When we do get down there, that's going to be our first real big meeting. Like, if you're mildly interested in any of the things that I'm doing with the Mint and the Silver Shield Group, or any of this stuff, you need to be down there. And when we get down there, we're going to start, saying, "Hey, let's get real about what we're doing actively or passively in our lives." And a couple of probably 3 or 4 people have already started to say, "Hey, I'm out of my business. I want to do something different. What can we do? Here's what I got. Here's what I can do." And it's been interesting working with these people, even on very little projects, to see that there is huge opportunities that will come out of this. So by spinning this abundance mentality onto others, like the charity was just a small example of, of individual abundance. I knew I had these coins and that they were very valuable, and I was blessed to say that these coins have been successful. And I wanted to help somebody that I saw hurting in my own personal life. And it was these two little kids with cancer. It was really wearing on me to go pick up my healthy daughter from school and seeing somebody else's unhealthy daughter, bald and unhappy and sad. And then, the parents are driving a, old car and stuff like that. And here I was, not like that. And I, it wore on me that I needed to help them out. And I did. My brother-in-law, I think I mentioned before that, he's just been absolutely destroyed by my sister and my parents through lawsuits and, dragging them through family courts and all sorts of stuff. And I recently helped him out, too, after 4 years of me licking my wounds over here in Ohio. I finally feel like I'm in a position now that I can be abundant towards other people. I started a gratitude log of things that I'm blessed with. This all has to do with getting rid of the toxic thoughts in my life that I spent probably 2 or 3 years after I left New Jersey, getting rid of those toxic thoughts, and then the toxic relationships. Over the past couple of years, getting rid of every single toxic person in my life. With toxic assets, and then finally the life path, which is what I've been doing the most. And I'm kind of leaving breadcrumbs for other people to help encourage them to do the same thing. So my efforts with the Sons of Liberty Academy and the charity and helping my brother-in-law out are all examples of individual abundance. My efforts of starting the mint and, my investment of Silver Message and design and marketing is an idea of institutional abundance. So, we could have very easily come out with these coins charged, double spot, and we would have sold a good deal of them and made a lot more money, and sold a lot less of these coins. But we've continued to provide a great deal amount of value to all of you guys out there. I know what these things are doing, on eBay, and yet we're going to maintain our spot price of $3 over, even though they're instantly going for double spot, as soon as we stop selling them. We're going to continue with the idea of having very limited windows and making them instant collector's items and having them become more valuable the day after we stop producing them because they're no longer available. That's an idea of institutional abundance that we can give to others. And we're providing value to do that, but we're going to continue to do that. Even with these limited edition coins, having it only available for you guys is my way of providing extra value to you. I mean, if you're telling me that there's some coins that are going to be produced that the public can't get, that only 600 people can have access to, that those aren't going to become very, very popular coins and they're going to be very worth a lot, they will. But I believe that what we're working towards with our group, our intellectual foundation, our maybe the mint or, commodity banking or something like that will lead to societal abundance. And then once we figure out what our societal operating system is and we show people that we don't need debt, we don't need death, we don't need war, we don't need any of this stuff, and that we can actually provide a tremendous amount of value by identifying the assets that we all bring to the table and understand the abundance mentality, the success that we're going to show is going to show humanity a better way of life. And I think that that is the ultimate abundance that we need to go from our individual abundance, which we are working on, to institutional abundance, which is, cooperation amongst other abundant people. And then the ultimate step, the ultimate exit strategy is to eventually have our own place where these cooperations and individuals can work in a fertile field to create a great amount of abundance for everybody. So I hope that the Coins for the Cause and the Mint provides this abundance generator that help provide value to those that invest with us, but also help enable those to spread this message. So that's one of the ideas that we have with this Liberty Mastermind down in Dallas in June, is to start saying, hey, if we start supporting these bloggers through either affiliate sales or advertising and stuff like that, why can't we help give a greater voice to those guys that are actually doing all this hard work for free? And then, why can't we get together and create a louder voice by saying, hey, we're content makers who have predicted the collapse of the dollar during a time when no one was listening. Why can't we be something much bigger than what we individually can be? And I hope that this ends up helping that. But this message will eventually provide a shift in consciousness as all these illusions are wiped away. So as we continue to spread the message of abundance and, being correct with all these things that we're talking about, this is eventually going to change the consciousness when all the illusions of the fiat world, the scarcity world, the all this stuff comes to an end. And I really think that that could lead to something very, very good on the other side. So thank you very much for listening to this Silver Shield Report, and we'll be back soon.